Welcome to the Wealth Matters Podcast, where investors come together to better understand how to build passive cash flow and create generational wealth without all the confusing mumbo jumbo. Here's your host and co-author of Amazon number one bestseller, Alpesh Pamar.
Welcome to Wealth Matters Podcast. I am going to talk to Mr. Taylor Lord today. He's a multifamily and self-storage syndication investor, having acquired or partnered on over $250 million in commercial real estate assets. He also hosts the Passive Wealth Strategy Show, a podcast dedicated to teaching high earners how to build streams of wealth and cash flow with real estate. So welcome, Taylor.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Absolutely. Hey, Taylor, so we start with this question with all the guests. Tell us something interesting or maybe funny about yourself.
Something interesting or funny about myself. Well, my biggest hobby outside of anything business related is training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I've done that since 2015. And it's my favorite thing to do to kind of de-stress and get my mind off of things. And it's really probably my only hobby outside of doing business. And I would recommend anybody thinking about training, just go for it. Just get started.
That's awesome. Yeah. And this is so important that you brought up the fitness side or the physical side, right? Because we live in fast-paced world and we are always multitasking. The first thing I do every morning is go to the gym and finish my workout. And that is, I think that is what I have been doing since 2011, and I have not stopped. 5 days a week, it doesn't matter. That is where we can de-stress, forget about everything else, right? So, you know, it doesn't have to be jiu-jitsu or gym. If it's walking is what, you know, entices you, maybe walking, running. But yeah, it's very important to start your day on the right side.
Yes, absolutely. I can't train every day. I'm, you know, in my mid-30s, so my body, you know, isn't quite what it used to be. But also love doing yoga. I did 75 hard last year and did a lot of yoga through that. So, yeah, constantly trying to exercise the discipline muscle, if you will.
Yes, yes, I agree. So let's talk about investment, because this is an investment show and we talk about alternative investments. What was your first investment and how did it work out for you?
So my first investment was actually in the Wall Street investing space. That's where I got started as an investor. It's probably 2011 or so, just S&P 500 index fund is how I got started. And that I did that for a few years and ultimately came to be frustrated, if you will, with the inability to really drive your returns in that type of investing, and started learning about real estate and how we can buy assets under market and force value add and everything like that. So that type of investing got me started in growing my wealth passively, so I'm glad I got started with it. But I'm also glad that I found a better way, in my opinion, a better way, real estate investing.
So when did you start investing in real estate, and how did you figure out that real estate is the way to go?
Sure. So the very short version is I picked up one of the great real estate investing books that pretty much everybody has read.
Rich Dad Poor Dad.
One over my shoulder here, Rich Dad Poor Dad, exactly. But that just got me started, right? He doesn't really teach you about real estate investing, just about the power of
cash
flow.
It's the mindset.
And the mindset, exactly. But that got me started down the road of learning about real estate investing up until my first deal, which was actually a passive investment in a couple of C-class apartment complexes outside of the Atlanta area. But my goal was always to get on the active side of things. I just, you know, needed to get my foot in the door, start investing. I'd invested a lot of my time and energy in getting educated as to how the business works. So started as a passive investor with the goal of getting on the active side of things.
That's great. And I think you just mentioned something, C-class, multifamily, right? What are the different classes in multifamily, you know, investments, and what's the difference between those?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, these days we might even, if I looked back, I might even call that a D-class deal.
Yes.
But, you know, to be nice, we'll call it C-class. But generally, real estate investors, we divide areas where we invest and assets that we invest in between different letter classes, A, B, C, and D. And it kind of goes in that order in terms of the age of the property, the rents that it commands, the amenities and everything related to it, A being the nicest and D being the most dated and lowest income properties. And then along with the areas as well, the A-class areas are generally nicer, higher income, newer kind of restaurants and amenities in the area, and better schools, everything that goes along with it. And then, you know, heading down the hierarchy till you get to lower income areas down B, C, and, you know, D type of areas in your different cities and, you know, submarkets and everything. And, you know, I've actually kind of transitioned and switched over. I started as a C-class multifamily investor, as I mentioned, although with the benefit of hindsight, we might call that a CD class deal. And yeah, this is one of the things that you learn as you start to dig into this. Those categories are not exactly well-defined. The nuances are all different depending on which market that you're in. It's not like you can, you know, there's like a checkbox that'll tell you what's A, what's B, what's C, what's D, and so on. But, you know, again, back to the age of the property. So got started in C-class and did a few deals there and ultimately found a few problems. So C-class properties tend to be much older than comparable properties that are available in any given area, the B's and the A's. And along with the age of the property comes oftentimes or typically some pretty significant deferred maintenance. And those deferred maintenance issues, you can find many of them ahead of time before you buy the building in your due diligence process, but you can't find all of them. There's just the unknown unknowns, the skeletons in the closet. And there's a lot more of those with older C-class properties. And it's not a one-to-one correlation, the age of the property and the class of the property, but for the most part in larger apartment complexes, it's a pretty strong correlation. Older properties built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s will generally be your C and D class properties. They also tend to bring in lower rents than B and A class properties, the C and the D class properties, and the tenants tend to be lower income. So when economic disruptions hit, the lower income tenants who make up the D and C class tenant base tend to get hit the hardest by those economic shifts, and C and D class apartment owners are impacted by those economic forces, right? Their problems become your problems as a C and D class owner. But for me, going back to the physical condition, deferred maintenance, that was the biggest thing that really started to push me out of the C class multifamily into B class, because we ran into a lot of plumbing and roofing issues that, again, right, some you can see ahead of time and budget for, but the ones that you don't can be very expensive, and you end up investing a lot of money in fixing those things, but it doesn't add to the value, yes, of your investment, because that doesn't drive NOI, right, net operating income, which is at the end of the day is the goal.
So this is a great point. And I remember between when I started investing, my first property, which I bought not in a passive but active investment, someone had told me, oh, it's a C minus. And after I bought it, when I went to look at it in Cleveland, Ohio, my property manager said that, oh yeah, I think we may have to carry gun. And I'm like, this is not even D. If there was E or F, I think that's what it would be, right? So in hindsight, now I know. But going back to that time in 2015, all the syndicators, they were starting there were a lot of new syndicators like this time as well. And they were all only talking about C-class, right? C-class, yes, is the best way to invest, because they didn't have to do anything to appreciate the property, right? Right now we have to do value add to force appreciate. It was the market was doing them all of us a favor between 2015 to 2020, where you just buy a property, do a little bit, and C tends to be, right? So right now then, which is the optimal class for investors?
Sure. So when it comes to a question of determining what is optimal, we need to back up and understand what our goals are. And my goal as an investor is to generate cash flow and also be able to force appreciation and buy properties that are affordable for the tenants at a reasonable basis for us, the investor. So that has pushed me into B-class, newer 80s and preferably 90s build apartment complexes. I don't want to go any more, any older than the 1980s. I really like the 90s or newer. So for me, because of my investment goals, that's why I've moved up into B-class assets. And to get to your point about what everybody was saying back in 2015, what the market looked like at that time, you're absolutely right. Everybody was kind of touting the benefits of C-class investing. But this funny thing happened that maybe not funny, but that we're all aware of. COVID happened and right. Interest rates fell and assets massively appreciated.
Right.
Crazy. So in addition to all of the physical condition issues that come along with these older properties, I noticed that the spreads between A, B, and C class assets really narrowed. So they all got more expensive, but comparatively, C class assets got bid up a lot more, you know, by my estimation. So not only do they have those headaches and skeletons in the closet still that we're going to stumble against if we buy these properties, but because of the effects of COVID, price appreciation, and everything, now we're paying an even healthier multiple. So for me, the kind of risk adjustment analysis and the risk adjusted returns just doesn't make sense to invest in those older, you know, lower rent income type of properties anymore.
Got it. So then it seems you moved from C to B class, right? Why is B class better than the other classes right now, right? I think you mentioned about the older buildings in C, but what about A class?
So that's a great question. So by my estimation, A class properties, to be competitive as a what we would maybe call retail investor, you know, a regular Main Street guy, kind of like I am, we're competing against institutions when we try to buy things that are much newer A plus class properties. And I've just seen that, in my opinion, they tend to bid those prices up and it's hard to be competitive in that space. Additionally, you know, I don't want to be at the top of a market, if you will. I don't want to be the most expensive product in the area. Personally, for my investment model, I can see I like owning nice things, of course, but as far as an investment goes, I don't want to be the most expensive game in town because, again, when we hit those rocky times, who's going to get impacted on the rents the most? The most expensive guy in town, he's going to get hit first, right? So that's why I like to play that middle of the market region.
Right. No, and I remember people, again, I was not investing at the time, but this operators kept saying that during 2009-10 bubble bust, the A class turned to B class and B class turned to C class, right? Just because, you know, people can't afford to pay that much rent. So we spoke about the class of the building. What about the area, right? Because that's how you also mentioned, and that is also we look at, right? Is the area A class, B class, or C class? So would you invest in a B class building in a C area? Or would you prefer to invest in an A-class building in a B area?
Oh, that's interesting. So it in the context of the question, you're still the nicest game in town because it's a B-class in a C area or an A-class in a B area. That's an interesting question. I suppose in that case, I would prefer to be the A-class in a B area because reading into the question and making some assumptions a bit, the A-class property is still probably much newer than the B class property in the C area.
Right.
But still, I'd rather have a property that we can buy either at or slightly below the market average and bring it up to the market average or above. And I don't want to go in and buy the thing that is already the nicest thing in town because how are we going to force value add in that property? But given the context of the question, that's the decision.
So I think it would be better to have a B-class property in an A-class neighborhood, right? So that's where you can force appreciate.
100%.
Got it. Which markets are you focused on right now and why?
Yeah, great question. So I invest in DFW, Houston, still looking at Florida, although it's a little difficult. It's difficult today with insurance rates and everything being so high in Florida, but still love Texas. I mean, property taxes and insurance have, you know, been an issue there. And I think you're probably going to ask in a bit about distressed apartment owners, probably going to touch on that, And there is distress out there. And I think for those of us who are looking for opportunity, that represents opportunity in a lot of these major markets that have very healthy employment bases and, you know, jobs and everything going on. So that's why I prefer to be in, generally speaking, more primary markets that are larger and have diverse economies.
Got it. And in this markets, have you built your own team or are you working with third party, like property management and contractors?
Yeah, we work with third party operators that are in the market. You know, personally, I think it's best to have people in those markets who are experts in those particular markets. One of the things that I saw happening before COVID and then a bit into COVID was that, especially pre-COVID, folks were really looking to get any deal done that they possibly could. And we're really pretty quickly heavily bouncing around trying to find the next city where they could buy because they thought they could be competitive, even though maybe they've been buying in Dallas, but we're going to go to Atlanta and try to buy in Atlanta. But in reality, there are already market experts in Atlanta that have said no to this deal at that valuation for very good reasons. And you're just kind of the new guy in town that's kind of overpaying for these deals. So I think it's important to be very careful of that, especially when you invest in different markets. You want people boots on the ground that really know their stuff.
Got it. And which market, which other markets do you think are right now in this situation, in the current environment, are solid cash flowing market or they are still growing?
That's an interesting question. So it's a big country. Right. I would start, if I was starting the search over again, I'll be honest, I'm not searching for other markets this time. But if I was searching for a market today, I would start with job growth and economic diversity. What's growing and who has a solid employment base? I would look for markets that are generally large enough to have a healthy supply of jobs and people. You don't want to be in a tiny tertiary market with one, you know, employer, a couple small employers that could really drive the base there. But also look at, you know, landlord-tenant law friendliness, very important. All those factors are, you know, what we've looked at to select the markets that we invest in today. Certainly like the Sun Belt, generally speaking, yes. Although there are pockets where it's difficult to make a deal work today.
Right. I agree. So I am seeing more and more reports about multifamily being in trouble, right? Because of decreasing rent, increasing interest rate, and increasing in cap rate. Is this true?
There certainly are folks who are in trouble. And there are markets in some classes where, at least on average, you're seeing some mild to moderate rent declines, like ticking down on average. I would say the biggest concern for someone in this space who maybe is owning a deal is the debt, right? If you have a deal and your debt is coming up, or maybe your interest rate cap is about to run out, you're probably in pretty bad shape. And there's been a lot of that happening this year. There have been several apartment owners who have either been foreclosed on by their lender or who have had to sell at a partial or total loss of their investor capital just to get back out of a deal. And a lot of that is due to variable rate debt and the expiration of interest rate caps that they didn't have the cash.
Yeah,
exactly.
And mostly in Houston, I've seen like 2 to 3 properties which went under. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, I think it seems like everybody in the industry saw back in, I think it was May or March, earlier this year, there was that huge foreclosure. It was very, you know, unfortunate for the investors.
Investors, and yes.
There have been a few more of those things that have happened this year. And furthermore, there are, I would say, things happening, what you might call behind the scenes, you know, deals being done where the investors are losing and a new buyer is getting the property at a good basis. And so far, what I'm seeing is that most of that is due to debt-related issues.
I see. And so do you think is a good time to look for deals or maybe wait on sidelines for now and start looking early or mid next year because there may be better deals out there?
So my opinion of the sidelines is maybe a bit more nuanced than others. I kind of hate to say that because it sounds somewhat pretentious, but I believe it's never good to sit on the sidelines and not look at deals. If you're interested in being involved in the market, you should be looking at deals. And if you don't find a deal that works for you, don't do it.
Right.
But that is superior to sitting on the sidelines and not being in the game and seeing what's going on. It's totally fine. Granted, it's frustrating to be in the game and not find anything that works for you, but you're getting things done. And then when things start to turn, if you're expecting things to turn, you will be there in the game finding those deals. The guy sitting on the sideline got out of the game. He's not involved anymore. So that's kind of my opinion of the sidelines. That doesn't mean that you're in the game and you should be buying everything you possibly can. I certainly am not of that opinion, but I'm not a fan of the sidelines generally, because I think the mentality that quote unquote, it's a bad time to invest in real estate is much more often used as an excuse to not put in the work and to not network and make offers that sometimes are like painful to make because you feel like I'm not going to get this because I'm making such a low ball, quote unquote, offer. But you're still in the game. You're still involved. You're still working with your team. It is frustrating, but I believe that's preferable to, you know, taking off your cleats and going and sitting in the stands.
Oh, makes sense. What are some of the mistakes you have made?
Partnering with the wrong people. I mean, for me, that's been the biggest. And there's a range or there's a spectrum, if you will, of what, quote unquote, the wrong people are. Sometimes the wrong people are malicious, if you will. We've had, and I've had property managers steal from us in a partnership.
Yes, so of course
that would be more malicious. Sometimes the wrong people are well-meaning, but aren't experienced enough to take on the role that they're assuming in a deal. So I've made both mistakes. Neither of them feels very good. I think the people who aren't ready to take on a role that they're assuming are, of course, easier to work with, if you will, but it's still a very important lesson to make sure that folks that you're partnering with have the experience and the know-how to execute on their role in a deal and also communicate with others. Communication is such a huge thing. And I believe, you know, folks, partners should over-communicate rather than potentially under-communicate.
Well, that makes sense. What has been your best deal so far?
So I'll give you two if I can. We did a deal in the Texas Panhandle, started that deal in late 2018. We sold that mid-COVID, performed pretty well, at least on a, you know, investor metrics basis. Forgive me if I don't recall the numbers offhand, but that was a C-class property that, you know, went pretty well for us. And, you know, looked a little rocky during, especially at the beginning of COVID, when it was not clear, okay, businesses are shutting down, but what are our tenants going to do for money to pay our rent? It did, of course, wind up working out for us, but things look scary there for a month or so.
Right.
But, you know, we were able to exit the deal at a multiple that was a slightly above our projections. So that did pretty well. And then on the personal side, so years ago, when I was single, bachelor, bought a really small place for myself. The property I bought for myself was $78,000. It was, and I put 10% down. I just loved how cheap the mortgage was on it. Eventually, my now wife moved in with me, and we don't live in it anymore. But we sold it in just a couple of years that I lived in it, and it literally doubled in value. So my cash on cash return was just colossal because I only put 10% down on the property anyway. And for young people who, you know, are working and have a solid income, I think there's a lot of folks out there saying, don't go buy a house, don't go, you know, buy your own primary residence because it's a bad investment. But if you're in a time of your life when you're still kind of used to having roommates and you can afford to buy a property and have two roommates that'll pay most, if not all, of your mortgage, and then you're living for free, you know, I wish I would have done that. I think more young people should take advantage of that.
Got it. No, I agree. What has been your worst deal?
So that was a deal, again, in Atlanta that I passively invested in, where The very short version is the property manager, what is also a general partner in the deal, is an incentive to perform. He allegedly stole some money from us. Deal didn't cash flow. We did make a little bit at the very end on the exit. I think that was mostly due to the market kind of saving us. But when you're in a legal battle with one of the GPs who was your property manager, it's just an enormous mess. So I've seen that setup kind of burn a lot of people when you bring in a third party property manager, but give them some shares to incentivize them to perform. I think overall that just doesn't work out. It's, I've seen that fail for so many people.
Interesting. Thank you so much for sharing all these golden nuggets. Are you ready for fire round?
Let's go.
Would you be changing business or investment strategy because of the current environment?
That is an interesting question. So for me, my business strategy, I'm trying to always grow and expand. One of the things that I want to focus on more of in the coming years is working with 1031 exchange investors who are generally tired landlords that want a more passive investment, and we can offer them an opportunity. So I'm changing my strategy in a certain sense to cater to them a little bit more. As far as the investment strategy goes, I would say it does change and evolve as the market conditions change, but long run, I'm still a multifamily investor. I have no plans on stopping investing in multifamily. That doesn't mean I buy and invest in anything I possibly see, of course, but at the end of the day, we have a long-term shortage of housing in a lot of markets, especially markets that have a strong, diverse employment base. So I see that as a very bullish factor. We just need to be wise about the acquisitions that we make and how they're financed.
That's great. I can see that you love reading books like I do. So favorite nonfiction book?
Nonfiction does put me in a little bit of a hole here. But one that made a big difference for me in my mid-20s at the time was one that's over my shoulder here, Crucial Conversations. Kind of teaches you how to have difficult conversations that, if mishandled, could ruin your relationship with someone, but it gives you the tools to handle those difficult conversations so that you can still have a relationship on the back end. Everybody gets to say their piece. And for me, that came to me about 10-ish years ago when I was at a time in my life where I needed those tools, and I still use them today.
That's great. Any tool or website you recommend or you cannot live without?
So I use a financial tracker. I've tracked my income, expenses, everything from a financial basis for probably 13 years now. I don't want to say exactly which one that I use, but I would recommend set up a tool where you can track all of your accounts, look at your expenses, track the value of your investments. Some of you have to do that manually, but that's a great opportunity to not only track your financial discipline, but also focus on the gain rather than the gap. You can see how far you've come. Yeah, we all want to get to some number that's ahead of where we are, tack a zero on the end, of course. But if you track over time, you can look back and say, wow, look at where I was and look at where I am now. I think that's very powerful, and it has been for me.
Yeah, so it reminded me, of course, the book. I think it's called Gap Versus Gain by Dan Sullivan. It's a great book. Any advice for investors?
I think the biggest thing in real estate in particular is try not to feel FOMO, the feeling of missing out. Take your time to make your decisions wisely. Real estate is still going to be here. If you have questions, go and ask them and get them answered. There can be a lot of time pressure in real estate deals because they can happen kind of quickly. And if you're new, you don't have that kind of gut feeling built up enough and enough experience to evaluate those decisions and make an informed decision quickly. But if you're new, take your time. It's okay to miss out on a deal as long as you learn something along the way and are more prepared the next time around. So try to avoid FOMO as much as you can.
Thank you. How do you give back?
So I regularly support a local animal shelter here where I live. And lately I'm donating to the Israeli Red Cross, Israeli Red Cross. I've never actually said those words out loud, but yeah.
That's great. How can my listeners reach out to you?
So if you'd like to connect with me, just go to passivewealthstrategy.com. You can click the button in the top right if you'd like to get in touch, or tune into my podcast, The Passive Wealth Strategy Show.
Thank you so much, Taylor, for your time today, man.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Wealth Matters podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes so others can enjoy the show too. Have a great week and happy investing!